crackdown in Hong Kong takes another worrying turn as authorities bust into a major newspaper, hauling off computers, notebooks, and executives.
Basically, the newsroom was occupied by national security officers.
Also today, when the leaders of the U.S. and Russia meet, it is must-see TV across much of the globe.
There's just something very appealing to, I think, most people, certainly Americans, about the two great superpowers battling it out.
And in the Philippines, the war on drugs has been deadly. Now police officers who shoot first, ask questions later, may be held accountable.
Justice seems to be working, and this is definitely a very big boost to the human rights movement in the Philippines.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for joining us. We start in Hong Kong, where today there was a stunning show of force against journalists.
Again, don't tell it.
About 500 police officers showed up at the offices of Apple Daily, Hong Kong's biggest and only mass circulation pro-democracy newspaper. As journalists live streamed the events, authorities marched into the newsroom, then seized reporters' computers and cell phones. Police also arrested the editor-in-chief and four other executives at their homes. Chris Young, the chair of the Hong Kong Journalists Association, called the raid shocking.
Basically, the newsroom was occupied by national security officers, 500 officers. It's unprecedented. They took away dozens of computers from reporters' desks. They target dozens of articles published on the newspaper and also on the internet, saying that they violate the national security law. So articles could become evidence of a violation of the law. And secondly, the officers took away reporters' computers and other journalist materials, directly threatening reporters' ability to protect their sources of information.
So you mentioned, Chris, that Apple Daily editors and executives have been arrested on suspicion of collusion with a foreign country or with external elements to endanger national security. That's the charge. I mean, it almost sounds like it's a charge of treason. Are you worried about what sentences this charge could result in?
When the first raid was conducted in August last year, the arrest of Apple Daily's boss, Jimmy Light,
right.
It has already caused a chilling effect and self-censorship among media. I think what happened today will make things worse and will make self-censorship more serious. Today is Apple Daily, and we cannot rule out the possibility that other media organizations will also be targeted. And that will, say, put pressure on them. They may censor their articles to be published in the future, and they might have to, say, look at their own archives.
Mm. Are journalists, you know, Chris, now practicing self-censorship? Is that where we're at?
In different degree, yes. And top security officials also call on other media professionals and the public to distance themselves from Apple Daily, saying that they are not a media organization. They are masqueraded as media organizations, but trying to achieve other political purposes, which is what they call causing threat to national security.
Can the Apple Daily survive after this?
Well, there are now more questions about their financial situation in the months ahead. They had also frozen the assets of Apple Daily, and also the kind of overwhelming pressure, well, orchestrated by the government and with the backing of the central Chinese central government to warn the public that they are now the enemy of the people. What's their endgame is? It's difficult to tell because under our law, we do have some draconian laws to suspend the operation of newspapers. Now, nothing is impossible. And perhaps the worst is yet to come.
I mean, that seems really worrying. How free do you feel today speaking out, Chris? I mean, do you think you're even a target now?
Well, it's a very bad day, I think, for Hong Kong journalists. The changes here, I think, not just to journalists, but to a lot of Hong Kong people are difficult to believe that Hong Kong would have changed to a very different one. And the worst, of course, is that you don't know what may happen. I mean, the media and also the society as a whole.
Have you been feeling like you need to look over your shoulder?
I have too. I think perhaps since 2019, I mean, Journalists Association has been one of the targets for a lot of black publicity by the pro-Beijing propaganda machine. Mm. But as a lot of journalists, I think I'm no exception. And it's really difficult to play safe unless you don't join the game and you just stop writing or stop, say, making comments. Otherwise, you know that there's a risk there. But if you're being overwhelmed by the risk and doing nothing, and then you lost the battle, I think a lot of journalists don't want to lose. We have to win what believed to be important and vital for the media and society as a whole.
One more thing I just want to get to, Chris, before I let you go. It's uncertain, you know, the future for Apple Daily right now, but it seems there's a lot of support for it still. I see that Hong Kongers are reposting articles online from Apple Daily and even buying shares in the company. So it seems there's a lot of support there.
That's how Hong Kong people react under an increasingly difficult circumstances. They seize every opportunity, albeit in an indirect way, to show their support, to show that they have not given up the fight. They might do it in a more subtle and, in a sense, a smarter way, trying not to get themselves into trouble. So keep the fight in a smarter and in a safe way.
Chris Young chairs the Hong Kong Journalists Association. He's been speaking with us from Hong Kong about arrests at the newsroom of Hong Kong's leading pro-democracy news outlet, The Apple Daily. Chris, thank you very much.
Yeah, good to talk to you.
In the U.S., Alabama is among the least vaccinated states. Less than half the population has received the jab to prevent COVID. But in a small Vietnamese-American community on the Gulf Coast, of almost everyone eligible is vaccinated. Reporter Sarah White's Coda Check has the story.
There's a blue and white shrimper boat pulling out at the dock in Bayou La Batre. It's a very small city on Alabama's Gulf Coast. The boat's called Lucky Kim. Trick Lay is the boat's captain. He's been fishing for shrimp ever since he and his wife came to the U.S. about 40 years ago, after the Vietnam War. Lay was a part of a rise in Vietnamese migration to this region in the 80s. Alabama offered warm weather and fishing jobs. Lay's wife, Wen T. Fung, hauls heavy buckets of ice from a big machine onto the back of a truck. The couple has kept working through the pandemic. They're relieved they're now vaccinated. Wen says being vaccinated makes her feel safer. She's not alone. Nearly all the dock workers here are vaccinated too. There are about 4,000 Vietnamese Americans in this coastal part of Alabama. Roughly 900 live in Bayou La Batre. When it comes to COVID vaccines, almost 90% of eligible Vietnamese Americans in Alabama have gotten the shot, community leaders say. That's in stark contrast to most of Alabama. Just 34% of the state's population is vaccinated.
You know, one thing is, like, I want to live. I don't want to die. You know, we did lose a few people to COVID.
Kim Lian Tran is a community health worker at Boat People SOS, a national nonprofit that serves the Vietnamese-American community. Tran's office is in a small brick building in the center of Bayou La Batre.
How are you?
I'm Dave.
I'm Sarah.
The Vietnamese community gathers here for holidays, or for help with day-to-day things like translating legal documents. When the vaccines arrived, Tran says lots of people called with questions.
For a lot, majority of them that has elderly parents or someone with chronic disease in their house, that they know they're protected.
Tran says her group also translated CDC fact sheets into Vietnamese. Tran says growing up, her parents didn't speak English. That's what makes her want to help.
Just one smile from them or, you know, that, oh, thank God I got this. Now I don't have to worry. You know, I think that's all that matters.
Just outside of town, there's another person who's tried to be a pro-vaccine voice here.
My name is Ye Châu. Thích Ye Châu.
Ye To is the Buddhist monk here. The temple is off a gravel road. There's a big lawn with magnolia and mimosa trees. The temple is inside a yellow trailer. There's a faint sound of recorded chanting. To points to the ceiling. There's black mold.
ảnh hưởng thôi, cho nên là
To says the rot is from last fall's hurricane. It's keeping his congregation from meeting for nightly study. Most of his congregants are vaccinated, he says. He says he encouraged people to get vaccinated and used himself as an example. He has a sense of humor about a few people who've pushed back on his advice. He says some of his members asked him how he's sure about the vaccine, since he's not a doctor. Tran, the community organizer, says she's seen hesitancy too. But it hasn't held most people back, because their goal is being safe at work.
I think the first thing they think is they have to go back to work. Everything else is still not back to normal, so what if there's a spike again?
Back at the dock, Truk Lay, the shrimper, unties a mooring line to his boat. He says it's possible to catch COVID-19 anywhere, so the vaccine makes him feel safer traveling by boat all year. For The World, I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek, Bayou Labatry, Alabama.
Sarah's story was reported in collaboration with AL.com, a news organization for Alabama. We know relations between the U.S. and Russia are a little frosty, or as Joe Biden said after meeting with Putin,
this is not a kumbaya moment, as he used to say back in the 60s in the United States, like, let's hug and love each other.
Still, in a meeting of powerful global bigwigs, you gotta exchange pleasantries and gifts. Biden presented Putin with a crystal sculpture of a bison and a pair of aviator sunglasses, like the ones the U.S. president himself often wears. Those gifted shades were made by a company based in Massachusetts, Randolph Engineering. As Randolph's CEO Peter Voskevich told CBS Boston, the gift caught him by surprise.
The phone started going off the hook. Social media was going crazy. And we knew then that, okay, something happened.
The company was founded by his father, Jan, and his business partner, Stanley Zaleski, both immigrants from Poland, a legacy Voskevich is proud of.
They heard a lot of good things about America, and so they came to America in pursuit of an American dream.
The gift of aviator glasses may also have been intended to symbolize something else. Randolph Engineering has been manufacturing sunglasses for the U.S. military since the 1970s. The company also outfits the U.S.'s NATO partners with their shades. So the gift may have been a subtle or not-so-subtle message. When you wear these, Mr. Putin, think of us. No comment from the Russian president so far on whether he'll be adding these new aviators to his rotation. Putin does seem to be partial to Cartier sunglasses. If anything, Putin's comments yesterday suggested that after his meeting with Biden, he ought to be leaning toward rose-colored glasses.
Oh, there is no happiness in life. There's only a mirage of it on the horizon. So, cherish that. It's hardly sort of, family trust, but I think there is a spark of hope in his eyes.
A spark of hope in President Biden's eyes? Hard to say when they're hidden behind those aviators. Just ahead, we'll have more on the big meeting between Putin and Biden.
This was the event of Mr. Biden's entire Europe tour,
where the two men tried to find common ground, but just couldn't see eye to eye, even with matching sunglasses. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. How can you trust an adversary of 70 years? That's a question for the U.S. and Russia and for Presidents Biden and Putin after their summit in Geneva yesterday.
This is not about trust. This is about self-interest and verification of self-interest.
That's Biden, of course, and here's Vladimir Putin.
Я лишний раз убедился в том, что президент Байден человек очень опытный.
Putin said that President Biden is an experienced leader and that the discussion was productive. It's clear the two men won't be going on vacation together anytime soon, but what could yesterday's meeting do to improve U.S.-Russia relations? To tackle this, we're joined by Alina Polyakova, the president and CEO of the Center for European Policy Analysis, and Maxim Suchkov, director of the Center for Advanced American Studies at the Moscow State Institute of International Relations. It is good to have you both to talk about this. I'd like to start with some of your key takeaways from the summit. Alina, what big headlines occur to you?
Well, I think this was a relatively short meeting. President Biden said he delivered the message he wanted to deliver to President Putin. And President Putin had the world stage, which I think from his perspective was a big win to be able to convey his message, not just to Mr. Biden, but also to his domestic audience at home. But at the end of the day, we didn't get much in terms of next steps. And I think now, as President Biden said, it's really just a wait and see as to whether this reset, and I do think it's a desire to reset the relationship by the U.S. side, will actually produce any sort of results.
Maxime, how was the summit perceived in Moscow, both on state television channels and, you know, more casually among your colleagues?
You could definitely say there were two dramatically different perspectives. Even on the Russian state television, some of the TV hosts said pretty much what my colleague just said. There were no major breakthroughs, and really, what was that about? On the other hand, I would say policymaking community was more optimistic. The understanding here is that Biden perhaps is dealing with two different perceptions of Russia in the United States. The one that is within the political establishment pretty much that sees Russia as a kind of global spoiler. On the other hand, you have a military and intelligence professional community that sees Russia as a key threat to U.S. national security in cyber domain, in nuclear and hypersonic weapons, and in space. So you have to deal with Russia in the sense to make sure that you have Russian capabilities under control. So pretty much all the activity that you need to do with Russia has to be evolving around these issues.
Alina, the Biden administration has accused Russia of election interference, human rights violations. There was a SolarWinds hack. And yet we saw a very cordial Biden-Putin meeting. I mean, during the summit, why wasn't Biden more forceful? Why not set up some concrete red lines?
Well, I think Biden alluded to the fact that he did communicate some red lines to Mr. Putin in their private meeting. You know, I do think it was a bit much to say that the United States gave President Putin a list of the 16 critical infrastructure areas that we don't want to see cyber attacks on. I mean, that should be pretty obvious, but perhaps that message was delivered more strongly, that if you continue this kind of behavior, especially in the cyber domain, there will be a reaction and a response from the United States, potentially in kind.
Well, what happens, Alina, if after the summit we see another large-scale cyber attack or something changes in Ukraine? Would the U.S. and Russia be back to where they started?
Well, I think certainly if Mr. Biden wants to enforce a red line, we could end up in a far worse position than where we started before the Biden administration came to power in the United States. If the U.S. responds, and if the U.S. responds in kind to, let's say, a cyber attack on U.S. critical infrastructure of any kind that the U.S. alleges is attributable to the Russian government, we could really end up in a quite bad scenario. And of course, right now, we don't have any international norms, agreed upon norms, to guide anything in the cyber domain. I'm very skeptical that the Russian side is interested in signing up for any sort of treaty or agreement when it comes to cyber issues, because this is a very important tool of warfare for the Kremlin to be able to develop these quite sophisticated cyber capabilities and disinformation capabilities to undermine U.S. interests.
Both of you, Alina and Maxime, during our conversation have been very careful about giving too many hopeful dividends from this meeting. Maybe it shouldn't have happened at all. On the other hand, we know the importance of face-to-face encounters. So if not now, this meeting, then when?
I would say that the earlier the two leaders could have met, the better, because the trajectory of the relations between the two countries has been downward for a long time, and the number of potential military clashes was on the rise. Russian and American militaries would collide occasionally in Syria. There were many of these kind of military interactions over the Baltics and other places. So I think there was this sense predominantly within the military that to avoid this direct military clash, we have to take the confrontation out of the military domain and limit it to a political, quote-unquote, ideological confrontation without any significant military risk. And to me, that was a primary driver for why they met.
It's interesting. People all over the world were paying attention to the summit. Maxime, from your point of view, what is it about the U.S. and Russia relationship that grabs people's attention? Is it like a hockey match, people showing up just to see if a fight breaks out? Some weird Cold War nostalgia?
Yeah, well, in a way it is. But I mean, the U.S.-Russia relations do not define the core of the international system the way that the Soviet and American rivalry used to define it. But I would say U.S. and Russia are still at the core of the large portion of the security agenda globally. This agenda pretty much occupies a huge swath of the territory from the Arctic to Ukraine to Syria to Africa to North Korea to Iran. So on all of these major international conflicts, Russia and the U.S. are major players and usually are on the different side of the barricade. So that's why they're still important. And regionally,
I would say from my own kind of experiences in doing a lot of the Middle Eastern conflicts, people in the region, perhaps erroneously, but they still think that if U.S. and Russia come to the table and negotiate something, things would have been better. Mm. I don't think it's the case, but still there is this perception if you talk about why people tend to pay attention to this kind of events.
Mm, hopeful thinking. Elena, what do you think is a draw to the U.S.-Russia relationship in 2021?
There's just something very appealing to, I think, most people, certainly Americans, about the two great superpowers battling it out. This has been depicted in Hollywood for decades. So this whole hero-villain trope is very theatrical. I think Mr. Putin often is framed as this sort of ultimate James Bond-like villain. So I think there's sort of this appeal of a kind of fictionalized, you know, battle between good and evil that appeals to people. And I think seeing that again, I think just invites a lot of attention. I was really surprised. I shouldn't have been, but I was really surprised how so many important meetings that President Biden participated in right before the bilateral with Russia. And given that the U.S. doesn't really have much of a relationship with Russia, whether it be an economic relationship or a cooperative relationship, but still this was the event of Mr. Biden's entire Europe tour. And that, I think, continues to tell us about how much Russia and Mr. Putin still capture Americans' imagination and the imagination of the world.
Well, we appreciate both of you keeping us in the realm of nonfiction today. Alina Polyakova, the president and CEO of CEPA, the Center for European Policy Analysis, and Maxim Suchkov is the director of the Center for Advanced American Studies at the Moscow State Institute of International Relations. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Environment stories can sometimes feel like a doom scroll, but we're also interested in solutions, reporting on climate change with a hopeful eye on the future. Find more of our solutions-based reporting in our weekly Big Fix segment and also on our website, theworld.org/bigfix. You're with the world. You know life is getting back to normal when live theater returns. Fans and critics are fired up. In Canada, though, it's a different story.
It is alarming to see that I might be excluded from being able to review a particular show because of the vaccines that I got.
We'll show you to your seat, maybe. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. If you fled your country for the U.S. and face danger because of your race, politics, nationality, or religion, you can seek asylum. Protections are normally also offered for people facing gang violence or domestic abuse. Normally. The Trump presidency made it much tougher to seek asylum. This week, though, the Biden administration is reversing some of its changes. The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, joins me with more. So I see that Attorney General Merrick Garland just reversed two key immigration rulings issued under Trump. What are the details, Monica?
So Garland reversed two decisions made under Trump that had made it nearly impossible for people to seek asylum in the U.S. if they feared domestic violence or gang violence. And it was a stunning break from how the U.S. asylum system had worked for years. And the Biden administration has just wiped those decisions away. And it's one of the biggest moves yet from the administration on immigration. And it affects thousands of lives of people seeking asylum in the U.S. with active cases and their families, and including people arriving to the U.S. today.
Yeah, remind us why the Trump administration made these changes, made it harder to seek asylum.
President Trump thought people abused the system.
And the asylum program is a scam.
He accused people of lying about why they wanted to enter the U.S.
They read a little page given by lawyers that are all over the place, you know, lawyers. They tell them what to say.
And the argument there was that people would kind of game the system, enter the United States, and lie about why they wanted to enter and wait for years while their asylum cases made their way through a very backlogged court. So Trump officials put restrictions on asylum, and it really struck at why people, particularly from Central America, say they're fleeing their homes. You have reasons related to gang violence and domestic violence. People say that if they're facing these threats, that they have nowhere to go, that the government officials, the police, don't provide any protection. So U.S. asylum law had afforded them a way out. So when this was erased by the Trump administration, there was immediate pushback, even globally, from human rights leaders, immigration lawyers, and immigrant communities.
What have you heard from people who've been fighting these changes made by the Trump administration?
Relief. I spoke with Karen Musello. She's a law professor at the University of California, Hastings in San Francisco. She's represented asylum seekers for years, for decades.
We had really hoped that this would be a priority and perhaps had hoped it would happen before now, but we're very, very happy that it's happening now.
At the same time, she also says that the Biden administration's reversals this week don't make it any easier for people to get asylum. These are very tough cases to prove, especially if you don't have a lawyer. And it's just a very difficult system to navigate, the U.S. immigration system.
What about the people themselves who are seeking asylum? How are they reacting to this news?
Well, I spoke with Dinora Hernandez, who I just met recently in Oakland, and she is seeking asylum from El Salvador. She says that she received very severe gang threats. She hadn't heard about the news, and so I filled her in.
Qué bueno. Eso es muy bueno. Qué bueno. Buena noticia eso para mí.
She says it was good news. You can hear the relief in her voice. Mm. But she also said that her lawyer said her case wasn't very strong before.
Porque, bueno, con la referente a las pruebas que yo le presenté, ella me decía que mi caso era bastante débil.
She's saying that her lawyer said she'd have a tough case because she didn't have any written threats from gang members in El Salvador, rather verbal threats. So imagine, that is tough to prove. Mm. Also, Hernandez is in California, where immigration judges may grant asylum more frequently. That is not the case in other parts of the country. The Trump administration appointed many immigration judges, and there are very high denial rates when it comes to asylum from those judges. So if you're in Georgia or parts of Texas or Tennessee, you still, despite these changes, may not have an easy time at all getting asylum because of the judges people may face.
The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, on some important changes this week to the U.S. asylum system. Monica, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
5 years ago, the president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, launched his all-out war on drugs. And since then, thousands of people have been killed, nearly all of them during anti-drug police operations. Only a handful of officers have been convicted of murder. But this week, a long-awaited step toward justice took place. Reporter Ashley Westerman has our story.
Back in 2018, International Criminal Court Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda launched a preliminary investigation into President Duterte's deadly anti-drug war.
While some of such killings have reportedly occurred in the context of clashes between and within gangs, it is alleged that many of the reported incidents involved extrajudicial killings.
Now, over 2 years later, Bensouda says she believes crimes against humanity were committed between 2016 and 2019. And on Monday, she announced she would seek authorization from the court to open a formal investigation. In her nearly 60-page request, Bensouda said that her office has found a reasonable basis to believe that 12 to 13,000 Filipinos had been systematically killed by the Duterte government.
The long wait is over.
That's Father Flave Villanueva. He runs the Arnold Janssen Kalinga Foundation, a Manila-based center that provides resources to families of drug war victims. Villanueva says the ICC investigation means a lot to them.
It's a victory. It's something that we have struggled for, and now it's a step closer to justice.
Police in the Philippines say that over 6,000 people have been killed since anti-drug operations started in 2016. Rights groups say a lack of police transparency means the number may actually be three times higher. President Duterte, who campaigned on eradicating drugs from the country, has denied condoning these extrajudicial killings, but he's also insisted that victims resist arrest. His spokesman, Harry Roque, called Monday's announcement legally erroneous and an insult to the Philippine justice system.
Obviously, this is intended to embarrass the president, but the president is a lawyer. He knows what the procedures are. They will fail. The president has said that if need be, he will argue his case personally before the International Criminal Court.
Roque also said that the president will never cooperate with an investigation because the Philippines is no longer part of the Rome Statute, the establishing treaty of the International Criminal Court. While the Philippines did pull out in 2018, now outgoing ICC prosecutor Ben Soda says the court still has jurisdiction over alleged crimes committed while the Philippines was still a member.
None of that at this moment matters because the most important thing, as far as the victims are concerned, is that justice seems to be working, and that the hope is that this will contribute to the end of the drug war policy in the Philippines for now.
Carlos Conde is with Human Rights Watch in the Philippines. Groups like his say that the drug war has done little to reduce drug use in the country or take down high-level drug kingpins. Instead, they say it is mostly targeted low-level pushers and users.
This is definitely a very big boost to the human rights movement in the Philippines, something that is important to us and to the thousands of families of victims.
Lawyers for victims' families say that while Monday's announcement is a big step, there's still a long way to go. Meanwhile, Duterte's war on drugs continues, even through the pandemic. The International Criminal Court judges have 120 days to make a decision on whether to start an investigation. For The World, I'm Ashley Westerman.
Fireworks in downtown Lima to mark Peru's likely new president. Socialist candidate Pedro Castillo appears to have won the election by a quarter of a percentage point. Castillo spoke from a balcony to a crowd of thousands this week. Castillo said the Peruvian people will democratically save the country. The race has still not been called officially yet. Castillo's opponent, Keiko Fujimori, is wasting no time claiming fraud. For more on this, we turn to The World's Latin America correspondent, Jorge Valencia. So, likely new president, Castillo appears to have won a quarter percentage point. I mean, things are still in the conditional, Jorge, but this does seem like a real victory almost. First of all, who is Pedro Castillo?
Yes, Pedro Castillo is a former schoolteacher, former union leader from Peru's northern Andean region. And he's a candidate and likely a new president who very much appealed to the rural, poor working class. For the first round of voting, he arrived at his local voting station on horseback wearing a straw hat. His main campaign slogan was "No more poor people in a rich country." So he very much tapped into the inequalities of Peru, the economic inequalities, the social inequalities, the geographic inequalities, even the racial inequalities.
So what's on Castillo's agenda?
Well, to be honest, Marco, I'm still trying to figure that out because Pedro Castillo's party, Peru Libre, or Free Peru, is on paper a Marxist-Leninist party. But Pedro Castillo has tried to distance himself from that. He is trying to calm fears from investors and conservatives. In fact, in this speech that he gave to his supporters earlier this week, he said that he is not a communist and that his government will create an environment in which both the working class and entrepreneurs will thrive. Now, the Peruvian Congress is divided among many parties. So regardless of whether he governs from the far, far left or the left of center, he won't be able to do just anything that he wants.
And why isn't Castillo's victory a done deal yet?
Well, that's because, as you mentioned, Marco, Keiko Fujimori, the conservative former member of Congress and daughter of a former president, is claiming that there was widespread fraud. Now, her complaints can be summarized in 2 points. First, she is saying that the ballot sheets at some local stations, the ballot sheets that certify the votes, were improperly signed. And second, she is saying that there were irregularities at voting stations where she didn't receive a single vote. Of course, elections officials are investigating these claims, but so far there seems to be thin evidence of what she is claiming. And international electoral observers say that they believe that Peru's election was clean.
Is Keiko Fujimori part of the investor and entrepreneur space in Peru that you're talking about that is worried what a socialist president will do to the country?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, when Pedro Castillo says that he is not a communist, he is largely responding to Keiko Fujimori, because Keiko Fujimori, as part of her campaign, one of her slogans was choose democracy, because many believe that under Pedro Castillo, Peru's government will become a communist government. So yes, certainly Keiko Fujimori, who is very much for free markets, is part of that class that has fears of a Pedro Castillo presidency.
So, Jorge, how long until we have official results? When is this thing finally done?
That depends on who you ask, but elections experts in Lima say that they're hopeful that by the end of June or the beginning of July, these issues will be resolved. There's optimism that it will be with ample time before the date on which a new president is scheduled to take office, and that is the 28th of July.
The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia speaking with us about Pedro Castillo, the man who we are almost certain is set to take over the presidency in Peru. Jorge, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
When Europe went into its COVID lockdowns last March and hospitals began to overflow, health systems were faced with a dilemma. What to do with non-coronavirus patients in need of urgent care? For example, women seeking abortions. A few European countries came up with an approach that some hope is here to stay. From Barcelona, Lucia Benavides has a story.
Ana Vargas lives in a small town, more than an hour and a half from Barcelona by train. When she found out she was pregnant this February and decided to have an abortion, she worried about having to travel to Barcelona in the midst of the pandemic. 4 years ago, when she had another abortion, she had to make that trip three times.
Cuando tomas esta decisión, que es algo complicado, lo que quieres es que se resuelva ya cuanto antes.
When you make this decision, she says, you want it to be over as quickly as possible. You don't want to have to travel much or explain yourself to others. In Spain, there's a mandatory 3-day waiting period for people seeking abortions. That means patients have to go into the clinic to fill out paperwork and then again 3 days later for the actual procedure. Depending on the pregnancy, there can be more appointments. But legislation in Spain's northeast region of Catalonia, which has its own autonomous government, has allowed women seeking abortions to carry out every appointment, except for the abortion itself, online, essentially reducing the number of in-person visits to one. Vargas says that for her, this made a huge difference.
Esta segunda vez no ha tenido nada que ver.
It was nothing like my previous experience, she says. This time, it was easier and more anonymous, and even quicker. To facilitate the process, Vargas sought help from a reproductive healthcare organization. The Youth Center for Sexuality is in a quiet Barcelona neighborhood. They provide support and services for sexual and reproductive healthcare needs. Paula Barrantes is a nurse there. She says requests for abortion services nearly doubled in the first 6 months of the pandemic.
Y más de 400 en los mismos meses de 2020.
We received more than 400 calls between January and September of 2020, she says, compared to 250 for the same period the year before. That's not necessarily because more people were seeking abortions, Barrantes adds, but because healthcare clinics were overwhelmed with coronavirus patients, so people resorted to centers like this one. She says 82% of the abortions carried out during those months were through telemedicine.
Con lo cual, la intención es que sí, que a la larga se pueda...
We want this measure to stay in place permanently, she says, because it makes abortion more accessible for people living in towns with limited services. Barrantes echoes what many abortion rights activists across Europe are saying after more than a year of seeing results from abortion telemedicine. This is in countries like Ireland and France, which already had easier access to abortion. In Great Britain, the government went one step further by allowing people to have medical abortion pills sent to their homes, as long as they are 10 weeks pregnant or less. While some right-wing Christian groups criticized the move, calling them dangerous DIY abortions, gynecologists like Jonathan Lord say telemedicine can actually make abortion safer.
Yeah, the evidence is just overwhelming and compelling that it is a better thing. It's kinder, it's safer, it's more effective.
Lord and his colleagues at the British Society of Abortion Care Providers looked at more than 50,000 medical abortions done last year through the UK's National Health Service and found that the waiting period for people seeking abortions through telemedicine was significantly shorter than those going through in-person appointments.
So it means they have less distress. But also the earlier stage you do it at, the fewer the complications and the less of an ordeal it is.
Earlier this year, the British government held a public consultation to study the possibility of permanently implementing abortion telemedicine. So far, it's the only country in Europe to do so.
Que las limitaciones son reales y eso es lo que decía antes, son muy ideológicas.
Nurse Paula Barrantes says women continue to face barriers when accessing abortion in Spain, where around 30% of people are completely opposed. Abortion rights activists are focusing on other priorities in terms of expanding access, like geographical disparities and mandatory waiting periods. It may be a while, Barrantes adds, before Spain can think about permanently offering abortion telemedicine through its public healthcare system. For The World, Lucia Benavides, Barcelona.
Lucia's reporting was supported by the International Women's Media Foundation. NATO is putting climate change in its mission. At its leaders' summit this week, the Defense Alliance said it would begin formally studying how climate change impacts security threats and how member states could make their military operations more resilient and less polluting. The Alliance said climate change makes it harder for militaries to do their jobs. Today, we'll also be looking at how understanding climate change can help build peace. Today on The Big Fix.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
Janani Vivekananda heads the Climate and Security Program at Adelphi, a research institute in Germany. She joins us from Berlin. Janani, what is the significance of NATO officially recognizing climate change in its planning? That happened this week.
I think this is a really significant step for essentially three reasons. The first is the symbolic value, the diplomatic value of affirming as a military organization that climate change is a threat to international peace and security, not just for the future, but one that's already playing out around the world. The second reason is more operational. It's clear to military actors around the world that they need to better anticipate and prepare for the resulting crises that climate change is contributing to. It's also an increasing need for humanitarian responses, one that NATO's historically tried to avoid. But as military actors are faced with more and more climate disasters, they're going to be increasingly called upon as first responders. They need just what this action plan is calling for, a better understanding of the interactions between climate change, peace and stability, so that they can ensure that military responses are not climate blind. They're not inadvertently making things worse because they're going in not really taking account of these climate risks.
As you say, these impacts are happening now. Talk about the example of Lake Chad in West Central Africa. What's the impact there?
So this is a tragic example. Lake Chad of the Sahel, which is made up of Nigeria, Chad, Niger, and Cameroon, home of one of the most intractable conflicts that we're seeing between state security forces and armed groups such as Boko Haram and Islamic State West Africa province. The drivers of this conflict are manifold, but climate change is making things a lot worse for these communities. 90% of them have livelihoods that are dependent on climate-related rainfall patterns. When I was in the field talking to members of armed groups, many of these people were saying they had no ideological interest or affinity with what these armed groups were preaching. They actually cited their decision to join these groups, join Boko Haram, for example, because of the climate-blind responses of military responses, things like slash and burn tactics, things like closing fish markets, banning the cultivation of certain crops or certain livelihoods as your livelihood is becoming less and less viable, not just because of climate change, but because of these military strategies, the offer of armed groups as an anti-state kind of vengeance mechanism becomes more prominent.
You've actually written about the relationship between climate change and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So in that case, how has an awareness about climate change by organizations on the ground help resolve conflict?
The relationship between climate change and peace and security can be this really negative, vicious circle which can lock in conflict. But it can also be a vehicle for peace building. So in Israel, Palestine, and the Levant more broadly, this is the most water-scarce region in the world. And whilst it's not the driver of conflict, the rising temperatures that the region's seeing, decreasing rainfall, and rising extreme weather events are all contributing to kind of worsening these very, very fraught relationships between communities. But we can see kind of green shoots within this. Water is at the center of the crisis, but it's also been used as a vehicle for peace building, using the environment and shared resources like water as a vehicle to create dialogue and discourse and ultimately trust between groups who would otherwise just not come together.
You know, a few years ago, the Pentagon cited climate change as a threat multiplier. How much further is NATO pushing that concept with its announcement this week?
It's moving us from the rhetoric to being able to work on a more practical level. I think it really is a sign that NATO is taking this seriously. Where we were is, okay, there's a link between climate security. And I think where this action plan is taking us is answering the so what. Okay, yes, it is a risk to peace and security. So what? What do we do about it?
Janani Vivekananda heads Adelphi's program on climate diplomacy and security. She's been speaking with us from Berlin. Great conversation, Janani. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Marco. Great to talk.
Broadway is back. Didn't you see Lin-Manuel Miranda on The Tonight Show?
Broadway, oh Broadway, you're finally coming back. I miss drinking wine out of sippy cups and a $20 snack.
The very first show to open up is Springsteen on Broadway, but as the World's Sarah Birnbaum reports, it's not open to everyone.
Springsteen on Broadway returns on June 26th. It's Bruce alone on stage with his guitar doing his thing.
Everybody has a love-hate relationship with their hometown. If you take me, I'm Mr. Born to Run. I currently live 10 minutes from my hometown.
Us tramps like us, baby, we were born to run.
You could say fans are freaking out, but that would be an understatement, like my mom. She texted me the second she heard tickets were going on sale and told me to clear my calendar so I could stay home and keep hitting refresh on the ticketing website. All this to say, Springsteen fans are hardcore. But there is one group of fans that is not happy, and that's Canadians. Some of them won't be allowed in the theater, and that's because Springsteen on Broadway has a pretty strict COVID policy. In order to get in, you have to show proof of full vaccination with an FDA-approved vaccine. That's Moderna, Pfizer, and Johnson & Johnson. A lot of Canadians, and a lot of Europeans for that matter, got AstraZeneca. And that, of course, doesn't count for Springsteen on Broadway. The whole controversy has inspired what is maybe the greatest headline of the week, Burn in the USA. The larger worry is that this is the first show to open and could be a preview of what other shows do. Kelly Nestruck is a theater critic in Toronto. He has to go back and forth to the U.S. to review shows.
It is alarming to see that I might be excluded from being able to review a particular show because of the vaccines that I got on government recommendation up here in Toronto.
But Nestruck says he has bigger fish to fry, like the theaters aren't open in Canada at all.
What I'm concerned with as a theater critic is when will I be able to review shows in my own town, in my own country?
Yeah.
Plus, I don't really like The Boss.
Mom, I hope you're not listening. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
From PRX.